Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI prays for the sick. An Irish sister who is also executive director for an organisation called Solidarity for South Sudan talks about her hopes for the new nation and appeals to the media not to neglect the good stories. And film critic Peter Malone tells us about the film that has just received the highest number of Oscar nominations. Benedict XVI says we must react to illness with appropriate care, but also with faith. The Pope, who was addressing the pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square for the weekly Sunday Angelus, made his reflections just a few days before the liturgical memorial of Our Lady of Lourdes and the World Day of the Sick. Lydia O'Kane reports.
St. Peter's Square was very much the picture postcard scene this Sunday as a blanket of snow covered the ground and monuments. Pope Benedict, as he greeted the estimated 10,000 faithful gathered, was wrapped up warm in a white coat to guard against the chill in the air. At this week's Angelus, Pope Benedict took his inspiration from Sunday's Gospel.
In the Gospel this Sunday, we learn of the healing that Jesus brought to many who were suffering from diseases of one kind or another. We commend him also those known to us who are in need of healing, and we ask him to take away our own hardness of heart so that we may respond more generously to his love.
The Holy Father went on to describe disease as a sign of evil in the world and in man, and he added that healing shows that the kingdom of God is near. In sickness, said the Pope, you can experience the attention of others, but he also said that you have the chance to give attention to others. Empathising with those who suffer, the Holy Father described disease as a condition that can become too long and difficult, and when healing does not come and suffering is extended, we can remain isolated and overwhelmed. The Holy Father made his reflections a few days before the liturgical memorial of Our Lady of Lourdes and the World Day of the Sick, saying we must react to illness with the appropriate care, but also with faith.
Lo ripete sempre Gesù alle persone che guarisce. La fede ti ha salvato.
In sickness, the Pope said, we all need human warmth. He also pointed out that on Sunday the 5th in Italy, the day for life is celebrated. As Jesus faced the devil, Pope Benedict said, the power of love came from the Father, so we can face and overcome disease by keeping the heart immersed in the love of God. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Daily news reports from South Sudan speak of violence, ethnic tensions and instability. Just last week, a shootout at a peace meeting aimed at ending recent violence left more than 30 people dead. Officials from three states and the UN had met for talks in the remote town of Mayendi in Unity State in an effort to reduce inter-ethnic tensions. The talks were called after a series of clashes, including one in which 74 people died earlier in the week. Meanwhile, thousands of people have been displaced in the violence. Analysts say security in South Sudan, which became independent from Sudan last July, is one of the country's greatest challenges. Born in Ireland, Sister Patricia Murray is a Loreto sister and the executive director of an organisation called Solidarity with South Sudan. As news reports tell of continuing violence and dispute in Africa's newest nation, Sister Patricia is adamant that its story of hope and peace-building find its rightful place in the news and in the history of the country, which she says has enormous potential to develop. Solidarity with South Sudan, she explains, is a consortium of more than 170 religious congregations and carries forward a number of projects to train teachers, nurses and pastoral personnel in different locations throughout South Sudan.
It's a bit different to a lot of groups and organisations because this is made up of members of religious orders, and Solidarity with South Sudan is a collaborative project among many religious orders to work together in South Sudan to help the local church with the challenge of nation building.
So it's a recent organisation, as recent as the nation.
It is very recent. I mean, it grew out of a visit that began in 2006 when we were invited to go down and see the needs of South Sudan after really two civil wars. And a group of six went on behalf of the two unions of International Superiors General, the men and the women. So we were representing all these thousands of religious congregations. And we went to see the needs. We also listened to the people for 6 weeks and heard their stories and their suffering and their trauma. And many of those memories stay with me. You know, one young man saying, I was taught how to make war. Now somebody has to teach me how to build peace. Or I remember women describing the horrific experiences they'd had from marauding troops and just feeling that there was nobody there to protect them or their children. And again, I remember the voice of a priest, Father Peter, who said, we're traumatised. Church, we're a traumatised people. All of us are traumatised. So that's the kind of context you have to look at when you look at South Sudan today.
Let's just remember, I said, how happy the people were when independence for the new nation was celebrated in July 2011.
Yes, on the 9th of July, there was an incredible celebrations in Juba and throughout the whole of Sudan. And if you like, the struggle for to become an independent nation had borne fruit. And there was and there is great expectation. But I suppose it's the lesson too of any of the arrival and the making of any new country. It doesn't happen overnight.
Because you know what's happening is that the terrible news that we get from the media now is shedding a bit of a shadow over all that happened. And people are wondering whether Southern Sudan really does have the resource and the capacity to
yes.
build itself.
Let me tell you a little story. I remember there were many journalists in Juba around the time of independence. And I would have to say, one journalist said, well, where's the action? Where's the trouble? Many were there because they expected there to be some trouble or some outbreak of violence on Independence Day itself. And I tell that little story because I think sometimes the media focus only on what I call the bad news, on the conflicts and violence, which indeed there are, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But I think we also have to focus on the many good things that are happening in South Sudan.
I'll willingly do just that, I said. Can you give me some examples?
For example, Solidarity with South Sudan at this very moment is training nearly 350 teachers in various centres. Altogether, we have trained over 1,500 teachers in the last 3 years, both teachers who have had no formal training but have been teaching over many years, and also we're beginning to take young people into training colleges. We're also training 60 nurses and 20 midwives as I speak. And I could replicate that. There are other organisations doing similar good work. My own particular congregation, the Loreto Sisters, we opened a boarding school in Rumbek to give young women in South Sudan a chance because there were almost no women in secondary education at high school in the diocese of Rumbek. I know in 2002 there were only 13 young girls in secondary school, and that's a diocese the size of Italy. And now there are 80 young women getting secondary education, and a very good secondary education.
Sister Patricia also pointed out that Solidarity with South Sudan is also involved in many pastoral programmes.
Through the diocese, working in collaboration with the local church, but also trying to build capacity. I mean, we have to remember that South Sudan is an area that was neglected for centuries. And that's why you're seeing conflict in other parts of Sudan. For example, in the regions of South Kordofan and Abyei and Nuba Mountains. It's the same struggle. The struggle that the people would have said the centre was developed, but that the periphery of the country, no matter where that periphery was, whether it was in the south or the east or the west, that these were totally neglected areas. And I read a story there some months ago of a woman in Nuba Mountains in her 70s who a reporter was talking to her and asking her, was this not dreadful, the outbreak of violence again? And she said, we didn't struggle for so many years just to get a few new roads. She said, we're looking for dignity. We're looking for respect. We're looking for the basic rights that people have in other countries, like the right to housing, to healthcare, to education and so forth. So if you're a neglected people and an oppressed people, and you feel that in these areas of South Kordofan and Nuba Mountains, they were promised, if I remember correctly, a referendum so that they could have a measure of self-determination and of self-governance within what is now Sudan. And that referendum never happened. So obviously they don't feel their struggle is over. Equally, the area of Abyei, again, that traditionally and historically the region of Abyei belonged to the south, but I think for administrative purposes in the colonial era they began to report to a town in the north. But the local people know that Abyei, the region of Abyei, is part of South Sudan, and therefore the contestation of where the borders of South Sudan lie, I mean, this is an area that has to be agreed politically between North and South Sudan. And again, if you like, this relates to oil, right, and the fact that 75% of the oil is now under South Sudan. And at the moment, you can read in the international press that the South Sudan is no longer producing oil because there was disagreement over how much should be paid per barrel for the transportation of this oil to Port Sudan. Now, I think it's attested that, in fact, there been overcharged because the northern part of the country, Sudan, depends on oil revenue and obviously ran its government largely from the oil revenue. So you have now these two entities, these two countries who both need oil revenue. I think for South Sudan, they're depending on the oil revenue for 98% of its budget. So you can see where and why there's a struggle.
Another area that has been given a lot of news coverage recently, Sister Patricia points out, is the area of Jonglei, where so-called cattle raids have left hundreds dead and many more displaced.
Where the UN forces and the South Sudan forces weren't able to prevent a conflict between the Lu Nuer and the Nuerle tribes. Now, it doesn't make it any easier, but these two tribes have been in conflict for many centuries. Now there's the availability of arms, and that obviously in the past they fought with spears and
so
they raided each other.
The availability of arms?
Well, with the whole conflict between North and South. So it's like in any country, the same was true in Ireland, my own country. You know, when you had, after the signing of the peace agreement, there still was the availability of arms within the country, both North and South in Ireland, which has had its own consequences and deaths. So, whereas obviously the loss of any life is a huge loss, and to see women and children struggling in Jonglei state and being harmed and massacred is certainly
reports are really horrible.
They are, but in a way I think it will force the South Sudan government to intervene in these conflicts, which, as I said, are long running over many centuries.
Also, the churches, Sister Patricia says, are trying to play a role in being peace brokers.
These are two tribes living in a very underdeveloped area. So where you've had a lot of underdevelopment, then, in a sense, the access to resources is is vital for survival. And I think that's what you're looking at, is tribes who are trying to survive in very harsh conditions.
Well, I found it really hard to understand, but I did understand that it really is about cattle.
It's about cattle, and cattle, cattle being the way of bartering and the economic, if you like, instead of money. Mm-hmm. It's how people do business in that area. The sad thing is that if there were peace now in this area of Jonglei Stage, the Catholic Relief Services from the United States was ready to move in with a whole program for teaching agricultural skills. But because of the conflict there at the moment, that money is now being used for relief. So it's paramount that these old tribal differences, you see, now that, if you like, the outside enemy is removed, we know this ourselves in ordinary life, then one focuses on the old enmities that have existed. And I think the real challenge for South Sudan is to build unity and harmony and recognise the difference between the tribes and their different traditions and ways of life. And that's where education is so crucial.
Sister Patricia told me that she herself has worked in the area of peace education for many years.
When working in the Irish context, one of the small little phrases we used to work with children who were very young is that difference enriches the human family. That's really a key to world peace, is that we learn to live with our differences and we learn to respect the other and we learn to find ways of accommodating one another, particularly in relation to the resources that are available around us. And I see in Jonglei State, the South Sudan government intends to get the tribal leaders together, and I know the churches will be involved in that as well.
Are the churches well accepted by the state authorities?
They are. I mean, the state sees the churches as having a key role to play in the formation of the new state. However, they see a certain separation between church and state. The state has its role to play, but the churches have a key role. But the relationship between government officials and the main Christian churches and indeed the Muslim community are good. And the president meets the leaders both individually and has also met them collectively. And I know for us, as we're a church-based organisation, as a group of religious orders, we are working in conjunction with the different departments in South Sudan, both the Republic of South Sudan's Department of Education and Health for the training of teachers and nurses and midwives, but also at the local state level. And I would have to say that it's these kind of partnerships that will bring about the future development that's so badly needed, because this is a very young population and there's a great expectation. When you're young, you expect that the fruits of peace and the fruits of the new nation will come almost immediately. And we know realistically it takes time. And that's the big challenge. And also, I think I would be appealing to the international news media to not over-exaggerate what's happening, but to interpret it in a context, both a historical context, but also a present-day context. And to also give a balanced reporting in terms of naming all the good things that are happening, all the programmes for women that are happening on the ground, trauma healing, peace-building movements happening at various dioceses, all sorts of training to upskill people. And remember, I mean, this population had no access. They couldn't train as plumbers or electricians or brick builders, or very few had access even to full-time primary education with war. And one of my memories in visiting in 2006 was how many government officials said, "Can we come to your schools? Can we receive education? We've been at war for the last 20 years. We've missed out." And that's what's wonderful, really. Education is so important.
Absolutely.
And I would appeal to donors and the international community to help resource education in South Sudan, both formal and informal education. Because this is the peace dividend. When young people can see that there are opportunities for training and opportunities for education, and can also see, I mean, that's where the international business community also has a role to play, because there are very few employers in South Sudan. because there is no industrial base.
But you're hopeful.
I'm hopeful. I'm always hopeful because I think when people see that there are possibilities for both personal and communal growth and development, they will see that the return to war can, on the one hand, destroy what's already been achieved and also put back the hopes of further development. We're aware of many peace campaigns that are happening at the moment at diocesan level. Our prayers for peace would be there, but also that the leaders in the community, both Christian leaders and others, will do what they can to try and bring about reconciliation between those who remember old differences and old hurts. And I think we need to support them with our prayers and with our gratitude for the work that they do.
So really an appeal for balanced information, which can be counterproductive, as you say.
Yes.
And an appeal to the international community to continue in its support.
That's
of a
right.
nation that really is struggling.
It is struggling, but any nation would be struggling when it hadn't any basic infrastructure. And therefore, we can't expect it to be able to react to the challenges within its borders as quickly as one would in a developed nation. Like reading about Jonglei State, the fact that it was the rainy season, there are no roads, so they couldn't get the troops there quickly enough to prevent conflict. So very basic, the basic infrastructure affects the measure of the response that you can make at any given time. But I appeal, I suppose, for tell the good news stories, and there are many.
As well, of course, Sister Patricia says, as focusing on areas where obviously the international political community can play a role, as can the African Union, which is continuing in its efforts to help bring stability and development to the world's newest nation. As Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone observes, when Martin Scorsese fans heard he was to direct a children's film, and in 3D, they were perplexed. It just didn't seem like the material for the director of Taxi Driver, Mean Streets and The Departed, to name just a few. But Oscar nominations speak clear, and Scorsese's Paris adventure, Hugo, is leading the way this year with 11 Academy Award nominations, amongst them Best Picture and Best Director.
Yes, people expressed a lot of surprise that Scorsese should make a film for children.
What is it?
It's a wind-up figure, like a music box.
Who built him?
I would think a magician.
You see this? Keyhole in the shape of a heart.
Another mystery.
I was talking with somebody the other day, and she thought that her grandson, who is age 10, probably wouldn't be quite on the wavelength of it. He might identify with the little boy at the centre.
Who are you?
Hugo.
Where do you live?
Is it a secret?
Yes.
Oh, good, I love secrets.
But probably Scorsese is drawing in the kids in some way, but probably adults will enjoy it more.
It looks very beautiful, I must say, and important also in the sense that the film is also about the history of cinema and it contains some very special frames, I think.
It does. The interesting thing, which I didn't read up about it before I went in, so I found it rather a delight to discover that there was a focus on one of the most famous of the French filmmakers at the turn of last century, Georges, I was going to say Méliès, but they keep pronouncing him Méliès in the film. And he was an animator around 1900 and up to the time of World War I, and had his own studio, made all these extraordinary fantasy films. They all had to be short for the nature of the technology of the time. But his most famous one, you may have seen images of it, was The Voyage to the Moon, where the rocket goes straight into the moon, which has a face and pokes the moon in the eye. But it was recently restored to its colour original, and Scorsese's incorporated that into the film of Hugo. So you get a chance to really appreciate what was happening over 100 years ago in that development of animation in France.
Well, I read in your review that each frame was hand-painted at the time.
Yes, the Technicolor process really didn't come until the 1930s. So a lot of hand-painting or tinting went along, you know, for almost 40 years before the colour processes were developed. So it looks very beautiful. If you've been looking at anything on YouTube, you've been missing out on the 3D. Because Scorsese made the film in 3D, and everybody agrees, and I'd have to agree as well, it's got some of the most vivid presentations of action in 3D that I've seen.
Where are your parents, little man?
The opening sequence is a chase through the station in Paris, Gare de Montparnasse, and right through the station and at the back of the clocks and all the space above the station. It's really active and vivid and colourful, and you are drawn in.
I was actually going to ask you about the 3D, because I get the feeling that often it's not really that important to have 3D, but everyone seems to go for it. As you say, it is in this film. It really does have a significance.
Yes. The trouble is, I think, some of the filmmakers are debasing the 3D effect by doing it in the post-production process, whereas the better films are filmed with 3D cameras, which is what Scorsese has done and what Steven Spielberg did for The Adventures of Tintin. So you've got the genuine article, so to speak.
Sounds like that the problem of this film could be that maybe children today, as you were saying, may not relate very much to the situation, to the characters, and maybe many adults wouldn't go and see it because it is branded as a children's film.
It's Neverland and Oz and Treasure Island all wrapped into one.
Yes, I hope that they'll go on the Scorsese name and the generally good reviews that the film has had. The two children actually are very, very good. Asa Butterfield, who was in The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, and Chloe Moretz, who was in the vampire film Let Me In, they're engaging enough to watch on screen, and there's enough story. Maybe it's better for 12s and over rather than 12s and under, but I don't think there'd be any harm in the younger ones seeing it if they responded to the story of the child, but also, of course, the wonderful story of discovering who this cranky old man in the station is and that he was once a very famous director.
Are you sure about this?
We could get into trouble.
That's how you know it's an adventure.
That's all from the English feature programme and from me, Linda Bordoni, today, but we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.